Good afternoon and welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community. Your host is Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community. This hour is designed to inspire, inform, and to help you live better with cancer. Now, here's your host, Kim Tibaldo.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, an internet radio show that focuses on informing and inspiring people to live well with cancer. My name is Linda House. I'm the president of the Cancer Support Community, and it's such a pleasure to be sitting in for your regular host, Kim Tibaldo, today. The Cancer Support Community is a global network. We're a nonprofit. We have 170 locations, including Cancer Support Community and Gildas Club centers throughout the United States and internationally. These locations, along with a toll-free helpline, digital services, and educational materials, provide around $50 million in free support services to patients and their families each year. We're very proud to be able to offer that to people who are impacted by cancer. If you ask a cancer survivor what their most vivid memory is around their cancer journey, they'll likely tell you two points in time. One is the day that they received their diagnosis, and the second is the day that they ended the active phase of their treatment. And while the end of treatment represents an important milestone and one that is really deserving of celebration, we do know that for many patients, cancer treatment doesn't truly end when the treatment is done, because cancer survivors now have their own special needs and concerns that need to be incorporated into their ongoing care. In 2006, the Institute of Medicine released a report that was called From Cancer Patient to Survivor, Lost in Transition. We've sort of shortened that to just be called Lost in Transition, but that's the formal name. And the idea was is to really highlight and showcase that lost period of time from patients receiving a diagnosis and what we would call acute treatment to now going back into their new normal or their regular life. And I'm sort of doing air quotes around new normal and regular life, because as we know, things are different moving forward. So today we have Dr. David Androsky and Dr. Jill Mitchell, and we're going to really talk with them about this concept of survivorship and get even deeper into some of the work that they're doing for patients. So let me start with Dr. Jill Mitchell, who is an oncology social worker with Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers in Boulder, Colorado. She's also the psychosocial research program coordinator for the Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers Network. Prior to becoming a social worker, Jill completed a doctorate in medical anthropology and psychocultural studies at UCLA, where her research focused on the experiences of women living with advanced cancer. Presently, in addition to offering individual counseling and support groups for cancer patients, survivors, and their loved ones in the outpatient setting, Dr. Mitchell also does research developing new programs to assist patients and survivors to cope with the anxiety and distress and to live more fully with and beyond their cancer. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Thank you.
Dr. David Androsky is a hematology oncology specialist, also at Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers in Boulder, Colorado, with a particular expertise in treating patients with breast cancer and blood cancers. And by blood cancers, we mean leukemias, lymphomas, melanoma. Dr. Androsky strives to provide care based on state-of-the-art medical science while remaining focused on all aspects of the patient's experience, physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And one of the things that I really want to highlight before we even get started into the questions is the service that Rocky Mountain Cancer Center provides to patients. It really is holistic in nature. So not only are you looking at the cancer, but you're looking at the patient who has the cancer and the family unit to make sure that what you're doing for people is really holistic in nature. And I think that you do that better than most. So I want to sort of shout that out before we even get into the questions. And David, I'm going to start with you. I'm assuming it's okay if I call you by your first name.
Sure, absolutely.
For the purposes of the conversation today, let's sort of level set our listeners and give a definition of a cancer survivor.
Sure. It's a great question. I mean, some people have proposed that, you know, people are cancer survivors from the day of their diagnosis, and there's a lot of the different discussions about the best way to define it. I think when, you know, when Joe and I talk about this and when we think in our own cancer center about cancer survivorship, we're really talking about the period for patients that have a curable malignancy, for that phase that starts once they're done with most of their treatment or the sort of the more intensive parts of their treatment. So to use the example of breast cancer, you know, a woman may get a diagnosis based on a mammogram where she may feel a lump. She'll have surgery almost always. There might be radiation. There might be chemotherapy in there, depending on the circumstances. And that's a very intensive phase where the patients are in the office very frequently, you know, maybe every day, maybe once or twice a month. And then that phase of the treatment ends, and they go to having much less frequent contact with us, maybe follow-ups every 3 months or every 6 months. They may be still on some treatment. Again, in the case of breast cancer, it would be often an anti-estrogen medication, but for other cancers, there might be other sort of longer-term therapies. But that moment where the patients are done with most of their treatment and we say, we think we've got the cancer and we'll see you less frequently, that's the point where I think we really start to think about survivorship and that the, you know, our relationship with the patient is changing somewhat, their relationship to us and to their cancer and their life is changing. And that's where we really need to pay attention to what their needs are at that moment of transition.
Mm-hmm. And so when you think about that moment of transition, you know, when is it the best or the most appropriate time to begin to talk about care in that survivorship setting? And, you know, we could use the word survivorship care planning. We could use, you know, transition care planning. But when is really the best time to start to have those conversations?
I mean, I think I have with my own patients have it at sort of various time points. You know, often some patients are really focused on the here and now, and they just want to know, you know, what do I have to do to get through the next week or the next month? Some people, even during our initial visit, will say, well, once I've talked about these are the components I think you're going to need for treatment, they'll say, well, what happens after that? So some patients kind of are already thinking, like, what's going to come in 6 months or a year? And so it's appropriate to bring up with that up with them then. I often will, you know, in outlining sort of the arc or the trajectory of their treatment, we'll say, well, and then we'll be done with all that, and then I'll see you less frequently, we'll have sort of ongoing follow-up for a number of years. Often when they're getting, you know, within a month or so of finishing all of their therapy, again, that intensive phase of therapy, that's typically the time when we'll first bring it up. You know, in our clinic, we have a, you know, survivorship counseling process where we'll arrange for the patient to have a meeting with one of our nurse practitioners or physician assistants, and they'll have a dedicated meeting really focusing on survivorship and on that transition. So it's, you know, we begin scheduling that, you know, a month or so before they're done with their treatment. And then it's often an ongoing conversation with people. You know, with most things in medicine, it's often useful to have the same conversation more than once. It doesn't always sink in, or people need clarification, or they forget something you told them. But those are sort of the times when it comes up the most, I think.
So for patients who may be listening who don't have sort of, you know, the automated, you know, points in time that you're mentioning here, so why would they want to have this type of a conversation with their oncology team as they transition into life after active treatment?
I think there are a couple of reasons. The first is that, again, it can be very disjointing for patients to go from seeing us you know, every week or every other week to seeing us every 3 to 6 months. And what I found is that getting a cancer diagnosis can be very scary for people. But when you have a plan and you have things that you have to do, I have to go to radiation, I have to do chemotherapy, they're really focused on the here and now of, you know, just getting through this week or this round of treatment. When they're done with that, all of a sudden people look up and they say, what just happened to my life? What happened to me? I didn't think of myself as a patient who had cancer. I didn't think of myself as a cancer survivor. And you have almost these sort of existential concerns pop up for people, which is a lot of what you know, the program that Joe and I have been involved with developing here is designed to deal with. You know, people just sort of they've sort of compartmentalized and didn't really think about those issues, and now when they're done with their therapy, it comes up. So I think it's very useful for patients also to normalize that, to say this is something that a lot of people go through, and the fact that you're having all this anxiety or you're depressed or you feel like you're not over it, even though all your family think that you should be back to normal, that's common. And it's not, you know, we don't want to leave you suffering there. but we also want to acknowledge that it's a common experience. But that's news to a lot of patients. So that's another reason to have that conversation. There's also just the importance of knowing who to call if you have a problem. If a patient has a cold, they can call their primary care doctor. They don't have to call the oncologist for everything. And sometimes patients need help kind of getting guided back to focusing on their other health issues. You know, often when patients have cancer, you know, they drop everything else. They stop worrying about their blood pressure, about their diabetes. And it's important to recalibrate and say, well, I think we've probably cured your cancer, but if we don't focus on these, if you don't keep mind of your other health issues, something else is going to happen. That may not be related to cancer, but we want to keep you healthy overall. So those are just some of them that could go on, but those are a number of the reasons that I think of why it's really important for patients to have these sorts of conversations when there's sort of a change in the nature of their treatment and the relationship with the cancer center.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Jill, I want to bring you into the conversation now and you know, probably for the rest of this first segment of the show. And, you know, we heard David say something about an existential crisis, you know, and a part of the emotional pieces with cancer. So could you just say a little bit about, you know, what happens? Patients are in active treatment. You know, it's a crisis situation. The team rallies together, and then all of a sudden it's done. So could you say a little bit about that patient experience at that point in time?
Right, absolutely. It can be such a surprise for patients. And we don't see this with everyone. So we do see a lot of people who finish treatment, and they may be cured, and they are just glad to be done with treatment and able to move pretty easily back into their life outside of cancer. But as David said, it's also very common to see people crash a little bit emotionally when they finish treatment. And so that fear of recurrence, that feeling of, well, even though treatment is done, I guess this shadow of cancer and the threat of what that might mean continues on in my life, and how do I learn to live with that and the uncertainty of what comes next? There can be a real sense of vulnerability at this time, maybe a loss of self-esteem or loss of confidence. Often patients or post-treatment survivors are still struggling with side effects of treatment, especially fatigue. And so they may be expected to go back to work, but may not be, or to their work outside of the office, and still feel, you know, very tired and not fully able. But there may be much less understanding and social and cultural support at that point in time. So their friends and family may be rallying around them saying, hey, it's great, you're done, we're glad to have you back. And they're feeling like, wow, this still is not over for me yet. And I am just beginning to process what I went through over the past so many months of treatment. I think this makes a lot of sense that this happens at this time, because when people are in treatment, there are often pretty clear goals. They may have a calendar of, okay, here's when your next treatment happens. You just need to get through these 6 sessions or so, and then you're done. But once they're done, then there's a lot less structure. And as David said, they're not coming in quite as frequently to visit with their physician or with their the nurses, or they may not see their fellow patients. And so they also feel a little bit more isolated. They don't have that support and that understanding. So now we'll say it's not all negative. People can have those challenging experiences and also be beginning to experience some growth through that process too. So, but it can be a very confusing time, and I think there's such value in sharing those experiences with fellow survivors and also receiving validation that this is part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. And we're going to come back to this social and emotional piece just after this break, but we have to just take a quick commercial break, and then we'll continue our conversation with both Jill and David. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Amgen, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Insight.
Cancer. It's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand, choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you, a breakaway from cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Eisai, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Magnolia Meals at Home, a new pilot program that aims to help patients by providing nourishing meals to households affected by breast cancer so loved ones can spend more quality time together. This program is currently available in and around two pilot cities, Andover, Massachusetts, and Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. Participants will receive one delivery of meals every month for up to 6 months when enrolled in the program. Each delivery includes up to 7 meals designed to help meet the nutritional needs of people living with breast cancer and 10 meals for family members. This novel program is brought to you by the Eisai Women's Oncology Program, Magnolia. Cancer Care, the Cancer Support Community, and Meals on Wheels Association of America. To find out if you or loved ones are eligible, visit online at www.magnoliameals.com. Or call 617-733-5848.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355. Or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Today's episode is being brought to you in part by Celgene, Lilly Oncology, and Merck. My name is Linda House, and I'm sitting in today for your regular host, Kim Tibaldo, who is away. And with us today, helping us to understand the longer-term needs of cancer survivors and how we plan for transitioning from active treatment into survivorship are Dr. Jill Mitchell, an oncology social worker and researcher, and Dr. David Andorsky, a hematology-oncology specialists. Both are from the Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers in Boulder, Colorado. And the Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers, for those of you who aren't as aware, have 20 sites across the beautiful state of Colorado. And it's one of the largest community oncology providers in Colorado and in the United States. So we're very happy to have you both with us today. And David, I'm going to start with you in this segment. You know, we just really talked about some of the psychosocial issues, and we're for sure we're going to get back to those as, you know, we learn a little bit more about a trial that you all have ongoing there. But can you talk to us just for a second about survivorship care planning? And we hear a lot about survivorship care planning. It's part of the requirements for the Commission on Cancer, and There's been a lot of work that's been done on that. But, you know, what really makes a survivorship care plan effective?
It's a great question. So, you know, the survivorship care plan is basically a document that we draft up and review with the patient and give them a copy of during their survivorship counseling visit. And, you know, a number of experts' bodies, including the American Society of Clinical Oncology and I believe also the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, they have templates that they publish that we've adopted for our purposes, sort of what the basic elements are. But the basic components are a summary of the patient's diagnosis, including, you know, the specific name, the subtype, any relevant biological characteristics, the stage, then a section on what treatment they actually got, and any complications that they may have experienced themselves. Then there's a section on potential late complications that patients can see. So we look at the medications that patients received or their treatments, and then we'll, you know, put in information about those specific treatments and the potential long-term side effects. And then there's a section on follow-up, which is, this is how often we're going to be seeing you. These are the studies that we're going to be doing. Will it just be office visits? Will it be mammograms? Will there be CAT scans in there? Will there be any labs? And then also sort of a more general list about, you know, these are things that you should call us about, and then these are things that you should call your primary care doctor about. Again, to differentiate for patients, you know, what's a more of a primary care issue that's almost certainly not related to their cancer, and what's a symptom that may be more, you know, concerning for a cancer recurrence or for a side effect of treatment that's emerging late that we might want to be more directly involved with at the beginning. So those are really the three components to the care plan. And it's useful because all that information is scattered in the medical chart, but it's kind of in dribs and drabs, and it's, you know, it's in lots of different progress notes. This summarizes it into a document that's usually 3 or 4 pages long. And we keep a copy of it for ourselves. We, in our record, we send a copy to the patient's primary care physician so that they're in the loop and they know what the plan is. And then we give a copy to the patient. Because what the Institute of Medicine, they published a report, I think it was in 2005, called Lost in Translation, where they described this phenomenon of cancer patients kind of feeling lost. You know, there's the psychological component, but there's literally patients didn't know where to go, were lost to follow-up, or didn't have the appropriate follow-up. Because maybe the oncologist thought that the primary care doctor was taking care of something, and the primary care doctor thought the oncologist was, and there wasn't a lot of good communication. So this is part of the function of the plan, is to get everybody on the same page, the patient, their oncology team, and their primary care team, so that everybody knows what the plan is and what the contingencies are if new symptoms or problems arise. But it's not just creating a document. We also, you know, we don't just mail the document to the patient and say, you know, good luck. We have them come in for a real counseling session. And often, you know, patients will raise concerns with us that they have about survivorship that we can't always anticipate. So having that counseling component is also really important. It's not just about generating a summary.
Mm-hmm. So, Jill, maybe you could take it from there and talk a little bit about that counseling appointment. And, you know, is that a point where you would do distress screening, you know, so that you can better understand sort of what their concerns are, or how do you approach that?
Right. So if at the survivorship visit, our patients are usually given a one-page distress screen to complete that has some standardized questions about anxiety and depression, and then also just a specific question rate from 0 to 10, what's your level of anxiety related to cancer or survivorship? And then those screens come to me, and for anyone who indicates a moderate level of depression or anxiety, I will reach out to and talk to them a little bit more about what they're experiencing, what's going on for them. Some people, you know, don't need anything more than that initial reach out call. Some people then want to come in and meet one-on-one with the social worker to talk more in depth about what they're experiencing, and it can be just so helpful to have it validated, what they've been through and what they're experiencing. And then many people also appreciate learning about support groups or this group intervention that we've developed specifically for post-treatment survivors. So that's the follow-up.
And so what are the most common concerns that you hear from patients in those early follow-up visits or those early survivorship meetings?
Right. So certainly fear of recurrence is a big one, even for patients who had early stage cancer and are essentially cured. That fear of recurrence and that uncertainty can weigh so heavily. And then related to that is the concern about, you know, am I doing enough? I feel like I'm supposed to be changing my diet. I'm supposed to be exercising more, sleeping more, taking better care of myself, doing this and that, and not letting myself stress out. And so there can be a lot of pressure that people feel to do survivorship right. It can also feel like a very lonely time. People may be questioning what was important to me before dealing cancer, before having cancer, doesn't feel as important now. And so what do I want to focus my time and my energy on moving forward? So there can be just a lot of reevaluation of life priorities and even relationships at that time.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm just trying to paint the picture for our listeners because the service is amazing. So when you think about, you know, your active phase of treatment, there is a pretty thorough physical review as well as a social or emotional, you know, review when they're either in the office or in the clinic or in the chemo suite. So in addition to the distress screening piece, what type of, you know, physical review happens as a part of the survivorship visits?
Well, I think when our nurse practitioner or physician assistant meets with the patient, they'll talk to them about, you know, any symptoms that they're having. I mean, when we see patients in regular follow-up visits, we're typically doing a physical exam, and that's another opportunity to really assess, to sort of lay hands on somebody and assess if they are having any ongoing physical problems. Usually, if someone is having issues, we'll kind of already know about it. I mean, the most common we see is a problem called neuropathy, which is an injury to the muscles, to the nerves that go to the fingertips and toes that can result from some chemotherapy drugs. That can be a real problem for people. The drugs that cause it are among the very commonly used chemotherapy agents, and the problem often doesn't manifests itself towards the end of treatment, but it can be really bothersome to patients beyond that point, and that can kind of linger on for a long time after their treatment. But so usually just taking a good history from someone about what's going on, what they're experiencing, is mostly what you need for that sort of assessment.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's very comprehensive, physical and emotional, and I think, you know, one of the takeaways from, you know, what I'm hearing is that patients and families should feel very free to come to that visit and be as open as they would have been, or even more so than they were when they were getting active treatment.
Exactly.
Great. So we are going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, I really want to talk about the study, Jill, that you had briefly referenced. I really want to dig deep into it because it really is pretty fascinating, and I think a lot of really good information for our listeners. So this is Frankly Speaking About Cancer, and we'll be right back after this commercial.
Cancer. It's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Eisai, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Magnolia Meals at Home, a new pilot program that aims to help patients by providing nourishing meals to households affected by breast cancer so loved ones can spend more quality time together. This program is currently available in and around two pilot cities, Andover, Massachusetts, and Woodcliff Lake, New Jersey. Participants will receive one delivery of meals every month for up to 6 months when enrolled in the program. Each delivery includes up to 7 meals designed to help meet the nutritional needs of people living with breast cancer and 10 meals for family members. This novel program is brought to you by the AZI Women's Oncology Program, Magnolia, Cancer Care, the Cancer Support Community, and Meals on Wheels Association of America. To find out if you or loved ones are eligible, visit online at www.magnoliamealsathome.com or call 617-733-5848.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I am your host today, Linda House, and today's episode is brought to you in part by AZI, Gilead, Janssen Biotech, Pfizer Oncology, Pharmacyclics, Takeda, and Tessara. Today's show is focused on planning for life after cancer. Think about survivorship in the post-acute treatment phase of living after cancer. And we've really touched on a bit of what survivorship care planning looks like, what the clinic visits might look like, the post-care visits. And we're so lucky to have both Dr. Jill Mitchell and Dr. David Andorski here from Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers. And I would love to spend the better part of the rest of the show really diving deep into a clinical trial that you are working on. And you know, I think you know we should probably preface the conversation by saying we are not necessarily talking about a treatment trial where you're looking at drugs to cure the cancer. You know, those are that's what normally comes to mind, I think, when we talk about clinical trial. But you're looking at an intervention to help cancer patients who are experiencing anxiety as they're transitioning into that post-treatment phase. And I know that you're doing this work with Dr. Joanna Arch as the clinical investigator, but the two of you are certainly leads on the study. So, Jill, I'd love to start with you, and if you could just lead us to understand, you know, what led you to pursue this intervention trial, and even term that differently if you think it would be helpful for our listeners, and you know, where are you now in that process?
Right. Well, so I think we have always been fortunate to be able to offer a number of support and educational programs to our patients, and many of those have some basis in evidence, but it's much harder to find approaches that have been fully tested and that we have evidence. We can show that this really, why this really benefits our patients and whether it's worth their time and to participate in. So I think for that reason, it's very important to be able to test some of these psychosocial interventions. So several years ago, I had the good fortune of meeting Dr. Joanna Arch, who is the principal investigator on all of this research, and she's an associate professor and clinical psychologist at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And she had done extensive work with people with anxiety, but hadn't really applied that to looking at people with dealing with cancer. So when we got to talking, we thought this would be a great group to focus on and to develop an intervention for. And so we developed a program that we called Valued Living for Survivors, and it's based on a theory called acceptance and commitment theory, or ACT for short. And it's a 7-week program that people participate in a group, and we meet for 2 hours each week in the group. And so we've been studying that for the past 7 years now.
And so let's step back and just, so the goal of this study, you already had a proof of concept study, a smaller proof of concept study, is that right? Or are we?
Well, so no, we started with developing a pilot program, and we enrolled about 42 people who were in that early post-treatment phase, and they participated in this 7-week program. And we asked them to complete questionnaires to assess their level of depression and anxiety and sense of vitality at 6 different times. So 3 times before starting into the group, then in the middle of the group, and at the very end of completing the 7-week program, and then at 3 months after completing the program. And so in that initial pilot study, we were looking at how does participating in this intervention compare to just change of time alone. And so from that, we were able to see that this might have an impact on decreasing their depression, their anxiety, decreasing intrusive thoughts about cancer and fear of recurrence, and also increasing their sense of vitality, improving pain. So in that initial study, we were able to see that this was probably a promising approach, and we were also able to get a lot of feedback from our participants, what was working for them, what really stuck with them from the program, what might we change. So we could develop a very formalized and create a clear-cut manual about how to offer this intervention. So that was the initial pilot study, and we published some of the data from that in 2015. But then, based off of that work, we were able to develop a much larger study. It's a randomized controlled trial. And so in that randomized controlled trial, we were able to enroll almost 140 participants. And some of the people participated in the 7-week intervention, and some of them just received usual care, which could look like anything from meeting with a social worker on occasion individually to participating in whatever other groups were out there or whatever else that they normally would have pursued. And so that's the study that we have just been finishing collecting data on. So we won't have that to present on until later, but that will give us much more clarity about what is the real impact of this kind of intervention.
Mm-hmm. And so what type of things are you measuring? Are you measuring a decrease in distress? Are you measuring what are the endpoints there?
Right. Well, some of the key things that we're looking at are how does this impact potential depression, anxiety, their experience of pain, their healthcare utilization. Are they seeing their doctor more often than maybe they need to because they're feeling anxious? How does this impact their feeling of pain, their sense of vitality in life? So those are some of the key things. And we're also looking at one of the primary mediators is, are we able to help people increase their flexibility with how they're dealing with challenging thoughts about cancer, like fear of recurrence?
Interesting. And I had heard that there that Kaiser actually did a study years ago where they looked at patients coming back for what they called worried well visits. Right, their anxiety was so high about, in particular, you know, a fear of recurrence or that there might have been something wrong, that just the anxiety is what sort of drove them back into seeing the healthcare team. And it sounds like that this intervention is designed to potentially help mitigate some of that.
Right, exactly. And also
David,
just help them with their experience generally and help them to move forward in their life.
Jill, can you repeat that? I think I interrupted you. What did you say there?
And just to help them move forward from this experience in their life so that a fear of recurrence doesn't necessarily paralyze them or stop them from doing what they really want in their life.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to come back to that as well. David, can you speak to the fact that, you know, this kind of a trial is happening in the community hospital setting? You know, when we first started, I talked about how I really thought Rocky Mountain is so good at taking care of patients holistically. Talk about this type of a trial, you know, being done in your particular setting.
So, you know, at least 80% of patients in the United States receive their cancer treatment in a community cancer center like ours, as opposed to being in an academic center that's affiliated with a medical school or university. And those environments are different. You know, they're less oriented towards research. They tend to be smaller. They tend to be more patient-oriented and less focused on research and training. But it's a different environment. And so a lot of the publications on survivorship and on these sorts of psychosocial interventions, when they come out of academic centers, sometimes those centers have big grants or, you know, lots of money and resources to put into the problem that just wouldn't be feasible to scale up and give to everybody. So it's good to show that those things work and it generates important data. But in terms of another cancer centers around the country, particularly community oncology centers, adopting them, you know, they may not be that adoptable because they're so specific to certain sets of patients, or they are very you know, intensive in terms of, you know, social worker time or things like that. So part of our explicit aim in doing the research where we're doing it is to say, you know, can we develop an intervention that works, that's also, you know, deliverable within a community oncology setting where most patients are getting their care? It'd be like manufacturing a drug, and then you can't really give the drug to most people. It's not as useful. So certainly we've drawn on, you know, research that's come before from academic centers in developing our own intervention, but by doing it here, as opposed to the more traditional site of research, you know, we can sort of demonstrate that this is something that any cancer center that's committed to doing this sort of counseling is going to be able to do. In addition, just for our own patients, I mean, we also have a very robust you know, drug research program where we have lots of clinical trials of the more traditional variety available to our patients, and we really believe that we want to bring the best of cancer care to our patients where they happen to be, and not have enough to travel to, you know, a distant academic center or somewhere that's way across town in order to get the care that they need. Because they're in so frequently, it's not, you know, once a year thing. They could be in here every week or every 2 weeks. So doing sort of cutting-edge, you know, psycho-oncology research is just as much a part of our mission as doing, you know, giving our patients access to cutting-edge research for oncology more broadly.
Well, and I know that you mentioned Lost in Transition, the IOM report called Lost in Transition, and there's also an IOM report that was issued around 2008 called Cancer Care for the Whole Patient, and it really did talk about the need, if you're providing quality cancer care, a part of that requires that you're providing quality psychosocial care as well. So you're really firing on all cylinders there.
Yeah, exactly, man. I think if you're in a patient-oriented practice environment, you know, you don't look just at numbers or metrics or what is your scan show or did we get all the chemo that we thought we wanted to. It's more like, how is this helping you as an individual within the context of your family and your community and your work and all that. So it is very important to be addressing all those different components.
Yes, for sure. We are going to have to take a quick commercial break. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer, and we will be right back.
Cancer. It's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Eisai, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Magnolia Meals at Home, a new pilot program that aims to help patients by providing nourishing meals to households affected by breast cancer so loved ones can spend more quality time together. This program is currently available in and around two pilot cities, Andover, Massachusetts, and Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. Participants will receive one delivery of meals every month for up to 6 months when enrolled in the program. Each delivery includes up to 7 meals designed to help meet the nutritional needs of people living with breast cancer and 10 meals for family members. This novel program is brought to you by the Eisai Women's Oncology Program, Magnolia. Cancer Care, the Cancer Support Community, and Meals on Wheels Association of America. To find out if you or loved ones are eligible, visit online at www.magnoliamealsathome.com. or call 617-733-5848.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355. Or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
People living with breast cancer often find it difficult to ask for help, and many of the people in their lives want to help but don't know how. During National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Cancer Support Community is proud to support Meal Train, sponsored by Magnolia, which utilizes MealTrain.com, a free shared online calendar, to streamline the process of giving and receiving meals for families coping with breast cancer. Help us reach our goal of 1,000 new breast cancer-specific meal trains this October. To learn more, visit MealTrain.com/MMT and enter the code MagnoliaB. Or visit us at cancersupportcommunity.org.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, and today's episode is brought to you in part by Agios, Astellas, Janssen, Taiho, and Verastem Oncology. I am your guest host today, Linda House, and we have been joined by Dr. Jill Mitchell and Dr. David Andorski from the Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers. We've had such a great conversation about cancer survivorship and really a different part of the definition than we normally hear. We normally think about cancer survivorship being at the point of diagnosis, but we're really talking about transitioning into that phase of life after cancer treatment. And Jill, I just wanted to go back to some of the conversation that we were having about the intervention that you have done a lot of work on, the valued living intervention. And I'm wondering if people have access to that today. I know that you had done a pilot study, that you are finishing up a broader study, but if our listeners say, gosh, this really sounds interesting and something that I could really benefit from, is this type of approach available to them today?
Unfortunately, it's only available within the Rocky Mountain Cancer Center's network right now, but my hope is that once we see the results of the randomized controlled trial, which we'll have later this year, if those are consistently as positive as they were in the pilot study, then my ultimate hope is that we can train more social workers locally and also across the country to be able to offer this at their sites. So, yeah, that's the ultimate intention, to be able to offer this more widely.
So stay tuned.
Yes, stay tuned.
Yeah, that's terrific. So let's talk briefly then about where people can go for support. If they are either beginning their journey or through their journey, when you think about, you know, the patients that you've seen over the years that you've been taking care of people with cancer, and you know some of the things that they're experiencing, this idea of, you know, recurrence and the uncertainty of being, you know, taken away from sort of that safety net of acute therapy. What would you suggest to them around going and receiving support?
I think certainly, you know, starting with their oncologist's office, and that they can ask about whether there's a social worker that they can meet with there. Unfortunately, not every clinical site has a social worker, but that's a great place to start. Cancer Support Community also offers a helpline, so there are social workers you can speak to over the phone if they're not available in your community. And they may also be able to help guide you as to any local programs, cancer support programs or educational programs, especially where you can meet with fellow survivors. I think that is so important, because one of the things that we saw in our program is even just in the initial session where we got patients together or post-treatment survivors together and asked them to talk about what were some of the fears and concerns that they were still struggling with, just to be able to voice those out loud and realize that they were not the only ones having those thoughts, being told that they may be cured, but still just feeling this intense fear of recurrence, being able to share that thought and receive validation for it is, I think, critical for a lot of our survivors. So that validation can come from a social worker at the site who's familiar with all of this, or from fellow survivors through support groups. Sometimes there are exercise programs in communities specific to people who are recovering from cancer. We have some hiking groups here locally. But again, yeah, some of the national resources like Cancer Support Community and their helpline can be very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Jill, let me ask you a question that may be on the minds of either our listeners or families who might be listening in. Is there a
is there a time frame for people? You know, if somebody's listening and they may be 5 years away from their treatment, but they think, gosh, this really sounds like some of the things that I'm thinking about or some of the things that I'm feeling. Is there a time frame where people are too far away from treatment or not far enough away from treatment to be sort of assisted?
I think it's so individual. It's never too late to reach out for help and support around us. So I think we tend to see a lot within the first few months after people finish chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery. That tends to be one of the most intense times. And then for some people, you know, they feel almost back to, quote, normal within a year, whether they receive support or not. But certainly, I do see patients who are years out and are still struggling with, what did I go through? And how did that change my life? And I still am afraid of recurrence. And how do I deal with that? So, yeah, certainly, it's perfectly reasonable that some people may still be processing that years later, and always appropriate for them to seek out support at that time.
Okay, great. Thank you. And what about anniversaries? Does that trigger anything for people?
Definitely. Anniversaries can be a trigger. Any scans, we have a great term for it, scanxiety, can be a challenging time. Especially for breast cancer survivors, the month of October or the color pink can be a trigger. Sometimes it can feel supportive to see all of that in October, but many times it can be just triggering for people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much for that. And I just wanted to hand each of you the opportunity to respond to just a question around, you know, any final thoughts. So when, you know, we've covered a lot here today, and you both have seen a lot through your study and through your patients. But, you know, thinking about the listeners on this call today who may be either patients or caregivers, and what final thoughts do you have for them if they period, you know, defined as lost in transition. What advice would you have for them? And David, I'm gonna start with you for this one.
I think what I would tell people is it's very normal and very common for people to have all kinds of feelings and emotions after their therapy is done, and to not feel like they can just jump back into their life. I think people are often, as Jill said before, very surprised by that, but it's very, very common, and people should reach out for help and call their oncologist, call their oncology social worker, talk to their primary care doctor if they're having trouble, because you know there are ways to help people. People do make it through these transitions, but if someone's struggling a lot, they shouldn't suffer in silence.
And Jill?
Yeah, well, that's pretty much exactly what I would say, just to, you know, acknowledge and validate that this can be a real and pretty common part of the experience. And it's sometimes we see patients who just fly through treatment, power through it, don't seem to have any issues, and then at the end, they're tearful all the time. And it can come as such a shock. And I think just knowing, no, you're not going crazy, that this is part of processing that experience. And it's a great time to reach out for help. The other thing I would emphasize is to caregivers and loved ones of people going through cancer to have some compassion and have a little extra patience during that time. But also know that they have been through a lot. And so that caregiver, that loved one, has experienced the illness themselves in some way, and that they may also need support around this time.
Great. Excellent advice. Jill and David, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been truly wonderful to spend this last hour with you, and I hope that you'll come back and give us the results of your study.
Absolutely. We'd look forward to that.
Thank you,
Linda.
Great. Thank you. It has been my pleasure to have a how all of you join us today for Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I am Linda House, the president of the Cancer Support Community. Kim Thibodeau will be back with you next week. And as mentioned earlier in the show, the Cancer Support Community provides a multitude of in-person, online, and telephonic support. For more information about our programs, please visit our website at www.cancersupportcommunity.org or give us a call at 888-793-9355. Until next time, be well, do well, live well.
Thank you for joining us for Frankly Speaking About Cancer with your host, Kim Thibodeau. We're here for you every Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. In the meantime, stay connected online at cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org.